Hello, my lovelies. Welcome to Out on the Edge, where we celebrate the rich diversity of our 55-plus LGBTQ-plus community, our queer elders, who we are, where we came from, and what we continue to bring to the party in these interesting times. Today, February 9th, 2026, our guest is
Joseph Meagel,
professor, the Department of Communication at UNC, whose work supports the development of new plays, screenplays, and short films, mentoring BIPOC and LGBT plus artists. First, let's give a shout out to WCOMLP, Chapel Hill Carborough, at 103.5 FM for hosting our show. Out on the Edge is brought to you by the LGBTQ plus Senior Resource Team of the Orange County, North Carolina Department on Aging. We are deeply grateful for their guidance and support. We acknowledge and honor that the town of Carborough and surrounding land was originally part of the Saponi people's territory, which also included the Eno, Tutelo, and Shikori Nation. Robin, you're up.
Well, hi. We were sort of getting our mics all squared away. Is your mic hot, Betty?
I think it is.
Is it? Hang on a second. We're just...
Yucks.
It's Monday all over again. Wow. How about that? In fact,
I'm not hearing things in my earphones,
here.
So.
Got caught in some traffic, so we are going to... Betty and I were having a great conversation earlier, and I'm just going to pick up on it right now, Joseph and I worked together for over 15 years at UNC in performance studies, and a lot of people don't understand the difference between performance studies and theater. So Betty and I were talking about that, and so I thought I would do some background on that now while we're waiting for Joseph, so he doesn't have to take care of it when he gets here. But anyway, the difference between performance studies and theater that Betty and I were talking about earlier is theater tends to work from the playwright writes a script. And once the script is more or less finished, it doesn't have to be completely finished, but there is a structure that then moves into the production team, designers, directors, producers, all of them, and then they bring in and they polish the script and they work on the script, and then they bring in the actors and they rehearse it and then they put the show on, and everybody is working from that initial idea. The initial idea for a story, it can come from a writer, it can come from a producer, it can come from a composer, it can come from just some, you know, conversation. The number of shows that have been started with doodles off of placemats at Wendy's is just phenomenal.
Yeah, see, this is fascinating to me because, Robin, whenever I think of a play, I think of, like, something printed that I can read, honestly,
right. and
in my limited experience.
Which is an entirely other conversation about plays. The difference between plays and novels is that plays are written to be heard, not read. Novels are written to be read. Plays are... Reading a script
that
tells you one thing, but you really, the next thing to do, particularly for playwrights, is you read it out loud. Find somebody else, read it back and forth, because it's dialogue. The descriptions are kept fairly small and concise in the playwriting format, because the emphasis is on the dialogue and the talking back and forth. So, welcome, Joseph.
Hi.
Thank you. I think
welcome.
Mic is good.
Yes.
Hot and stuff like that. And we'll do all
We're not trusting the headphones.
Yeah.
So just use your mic.
You're kind of wonky. No, go ahead. Get yourself settled. This is the live part that audiences really love when things screw up on stage.
Yeah, this is my my flaky days.
Joseph is
okay.
With headphones afterwards. So, but
it worked out well.
That's theater.
Right.
Theater generally starts from a written script. No matter where it comes from, it's structured before it moves into production. In performance studies, and this is what Joseph and I were doing for all those years at Swain, and he keeps doing, or was doing, is we start with just the concept. And everybody, the performers and the designers and the director, everybody comes in and they start figuring out how to put that concept on stage. And then the script is generated simultaneously. And so, as I said, one of the things that was most frustrating to me is as exciting and as invigorating as supercharged as I was from years of theater to come into performance studies and find that looseness and to be a designer in a much more involved creative aspect of it rather than just interpreting things visually. That was great, but because as Joseph heard me complain frequently, not having a script to work to generate lighting cues until the day before the show was extremely aggravating.
Creativity is always stressful, isn't it?
I'm sorry?
Creativity is always stressful.
Yes, and it was just there, but there were some of the most exciting things. Again, as you and I were talking about, the most visceral, emotionally raw, insightful things that I ever worked on came from creating that as part of the process and creating performance. Mm-hmm. And I took three or four times, I took Joseph's class in creating performance, and we were developing with students all along things like this. The show you saw last year, Judy, with the trans woman during her senior project, the ones that a grad student who was exploring gender fluidity and being agender. I was unsure because I was the first person, non-binary person I'd ever met. And it was fascinating to me to come in every day to work on the lights, and they had come in and changed the set around. It's like, oh
wow,
I'm gonna move the lights, stuff like that. So anyway, that's kind of a nutshell, a very big nutshell difference between theater and performance studies. And so
right and that's what Robin and I were talking about on the way here, because right. Joseph, I had no idea.
Robertson Street.
That's okay.
Then turn right onto Sweet Bay Place.
It'll stop. but I had no idea, you know. It's like I have no experience in the background of performance and theater except appreciating what I have seen. And it was fascinating to hear how things have been broken down and how things are learned and studied in an academic environment, and an excellent academic environment, because I know UNC has a huge, huge history of performance and playwriting.
Before I say Joseph, I was just thinking how much like a devised show, that's a good word for it, is a devised show, this whole beginning of our show has been this time. We've just been sort of throwing it together as we go along, and we'll say, oh, let's keep this, and we'll keep this, and we'll keep that. But thank you. Now that our guest is here, has had a chance to catch his breath, welcome. Thank you for coming to Out on the Edge. This is Betty.
Hi, good
Betty.
To meet you.
This is Joseph.
And I may walk out just to make sure everything's working like we expect.
She'll be right back. And this, on the layers of everything else, this is the first time Joseph and I have been in the same room and seen each other since I came out.
Ah.
So I did not do any makeup or anything like that because I didn't want to shock him.
Oh, I would be fine.
Joseph,
he would be totally shocked.
Me, Robin.
Totally shocked.
Yes.
So, but I am not the first trans person you know or have worked with. So why don't you talk about Joseph's background? As we discussed, one of the things we were trying to do with the show is create archives of queer histories that cannot be sullied and rewritten by powers that be. So tell us about your background.
Oh, there's so much. Like I'm pretty old. So
you're the youngest person in the room.
Well, there you go.
You are.
So I was in Los Angeles getting a master's degree, and I started doing a lot of theater, which is sort of antithetical in Los Angeles. People like to do film and television, and they only do theater as a way of, like, auditioning for TV and film. But I was very serious about the theater I created there. And I worked on with several theater companies and became artistic director of several theater companies, including Words Across Cultures, which was a multicultural theater company before that was like a thing. And then before it was an anti-thing, right? So those were I was always involved in that. And one of the first, I was also doing a radio show on Pacifica Radio, KPFK. Which had a show called IMRU, by the way, which I was on several times. But I did a morning radio show and met Guillermo Reyes, who's a playwright and a short story writer. And I read one of his short stories called Miss Consuelo. And he's a queer Latino playwright. And I read this short story called Miss Consuelo. And I was working with a multicultural theater company, as I said. And I said, that would make a great play. And we turned Miss Consuelo into a play,
right?
Which was a sort of a campy comedy about a Mexican maid who wanted to be a playwright. And but it was very campy. It had sort of a gay chic thing going on. But then he also wrote a one-person show called Men on the Verge of a His Panic Breakdown, His Dash Panic his Breakdown, and which was basically a one-person show about six different Latino, gay, Catholic, immigrant men, right? And so, but you, when you think about that, you think about, oh, that's one type of man. There were six very different type of guys, right? And at first, Guillermo did it, and we did it in Phoenix, and I said, this would be an amazing play if we got an actor. Which, of course, is insulting to Guillermo at the time. But he agreed, and we found a really wonderful actor, not the nicest guy in the world, but a wonderful actor named Felix Pyre. And we opened it in at the Celebration Theater, which is a gay and lesbian theater in Los Angeles, and it ran for a year. It won an Ovation Award for Guillermo, an Ovation Award. It just kept on going, and we moved it to New York, and it also ran off Broadway for 9 months.
So you were hooked.
Yeah, well, yeah. So, and the work I've been doing mostly is new work, very multicultural, very, diverse. But the queer aesthetic has always been a big part of the work I do, and I've been doing it for a long time. Went to the Playwrights Theater of New Jersey and became artistic director there. I did, bunches of plays there, including Guillermo's. And then eventually I came here and started teaching 21 years ago at UNC Chapel Hill in performance studies. And at that point, I started bringing plays in. I started working with you, Robin, as my designer and technical director, and we created some really wonderful plays. Dream Boy by Jim Grimsley. Jim Grimsley is a wonderful queer playwright. Dream Boy was not his play; it was his book, and we created a play out of it, and I think it was one of the best things I've ever done.
Well, that Shakespeare's R&J was also an amazing production. A very, very queer interpretation of it.
Absolutely. So, but Dream Boy is one of my favorite plays that I've done over the years. And then I created the thing called the Process Series, which is basically embracing new works of all types of disciplines, and we bring artists from all around. I brought Guillermo a couple times. I brought other queer artists in several times. And basically it celebrates the creation of new work. And we have the artist in residence for about a week. And then on a Friday, Saturday, usually we do performances for the public so that they can respond to the work as it is at that time in the process. So it could be just a reading of a play.
Incorporate into their work.
And that, they learn from it.
It's a feedback loop.
It's a feedback loop.
And
it's the way plays get developed all the time.
Yeah.
It was interesting to work in other disciplines like composition or music, where not every artist works in development the same way.
You know?
And you learn things about, most composers don't think any note that they have written is wrong. They think it's the way it's played that is wrong.
Of course, yes, exactly.
but I am accustomed to playwrights and how playwrights work. And they really need that collaborative. They need to hear actors read their words. They need to see directors deal with their work.
Right.
And in the reading, in early stages, readings are very helpful. I call them concert readings because I put all the actors at music stands when they're in the scene, and then they sit down when they're not in the scene. And I think it's a really interesting and a way to hear a play.
It's
almost like a radio play, but you see the expressions and the bodies of the actors in space.
That sounds like great fun and something I would like experiencing. So I'm just curious, how does one go to see these things at UNC, if you don't mind me asking.
I've been promoting the process series for 18 years.
Okay,
I send out press releases and everything.
Yeah. Okay, they don't always reach interested audiences, unfortunately.
No, they don't, but do they? I would say that we were the best-kept secret on campus for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. I think we have developed also a very loyal audience. It's a key audience.
I can believe it.
Yeah, people who know us.
And people who like this kind of thing want to go.
And then we put them on our mailing list. And, you know, hopefully, if it weren't the last year, we would continue to see it grow and see more people.
It has a definite appeal for people who are interested in the process.
Right.
A series of processes, if you want to. But as you and I were talking about with your experience with coming in and seeing a finished script that everybody has put together up on stage with a finished script, the process series is fascinating about letting you see how it is. I mean, it's like being able to stand back and watch the baker punch down the sourdough every so often instead of just coming in and buying a loaf and walking out the door.
Wow.
Helped Joseph start the series as a technical support. I was actually in one of them when Tori Ralston did the whole puppet thing, and I was in that along with everything else. And we found multiple spaces on campus, working a lot with Carolina Performing Arts, with Trump Theater Department, and it became there was a lot of collaboration, but it was by people who support the creation of the performance rather than just wanting to see the finished performance in and of itself. We took one of the early ones that we did in the process series was a piece called Trojan Barbie.
Yes.
Which was about the time travel loop thing, and it was really strange and everything like that. And the playwright came back several years, and we actually put it on as a finished script.
Yes.
Several years later.
Mm-hmm. Yes. You know,
and one of the things, not right this second, but before we go, I want you to just sort of, as a wonderfully illustration of this process, to talk about freight.
Okay.
Where it came from, where it was wound up, because I was just starting to explain ekphrastic
good.
Sources to them, because I've actually done quite a bit of ekphrastic poetry lately. But that was a play that is played off-Broadway that started with a painting at the Ackman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Slow Down Freight Train by Piper. I'm forgetting her first name, the artist.
Yeah, it's a beautiful painting.
Howard Kraft joined a group of playwrights that were asked to write pieces based on art pieces at the Ackland.
Mm-hmm.
And he saw this... this painting called Slow Down Freight Train. And based on that, he created a piece called The Minstrel.
And
The Minstrel was basically about a black performer in the 1910s who, in order to make a living, found a way to be a black minstrel performer, which, of course, is a flawed way of making a living, yet... Yeah. It was a successful way for him to make a living.
That was an industry standard.
Yeah, and so it was we did this, the minstrel in front of the painting originally for like 20 people at a time because that's all could fit. And there's one moment, and we cast Alphonse Nicholson, who was the guy who's been in this place ever since and has an amazing career. But that will come up later. But what I love about it is that there's a moment in The Minstrel where he sees a lynched body, and it's, you know, who's totally been torn apart, and it's just horrific to see. And he sees it, and he's looking at the thing, and he says, "There's dolls and lipstick on and cigarette butts on the ground, some with lipstick on it." And I said, when you say some with lipstick on them, you have to look at someone in the audience who's a white woman and say that to that person, because that was an extraordinary moment in The Minstrel. And it was so dynamic, and I knew that there was something really magical about this. And so we talked to Howard, Alphonse and I think both talked to Howard, and said we need to make a full length. And there was a time where he was talking about doing a piece called The History of Civil Rights Unabridged, which was taking off of another comedy called The History of the World Unabridged. And it's sort of it's a comic trope for this. And he sort of came up with an idea. What if we took this character, Abel Green, who was in This Minstrel in 1910s, and put that same being in five different time periods? So it would be Abel Green coming back in a reincarnated type of way. And so the second iteration, he's a very dynamic preacher, right? And he's very successful, but he's really, you know, using that success to have a grand lifestyle. And the next iteration, he's a snitch for the FBI, based on the real story of the snitch against the Black Panthers. And the next iteration, he is an actor who ends up being a little homophobic, and so he has to deal with his own homophobia. So, and then the final iteration, you meet him as a homeless guy, but you find out he sold these terrible loans to black and brown people right before the crash, and he ruined people's lives. And in each case, there is a flaw in Abel Green that he has to learn from, and that's sort of that's the dynamic. But it's also a flaw that comes out of being a black person in that time period and that place in history.
Mm-hmm.
So this is an extraordinary piece of writing.
Yeah. It sounds it like is. It.
And Alphonse Nicholson is up to the challenge. He's an amazing actor. I sort of cast him in an early process series event called by Howard called Caleb Calypso and the Midnight Marauders.
Right, yeah, I was just going to say that. We'd already, so it was sort of a known quotient, but the fact that, I used to, Alphonse used to, when he's, I think had his first child, he would raise extra money. He would sit on the corner of Franklin Columbia and play drums.
Yeah, he's quite a good drummer.
And he's incredible.
He would make, and New York, when he lived in New York, he would make $500 a day. He would do a play in the day or in the night, and then he would drum.
Drum, yeah. And he's a wonderful human being, too. I mean, that's just one of the things. Joseph has a tolerance for poo-poo heads, the same as I do, but Alphonse was just, what a mensch. He's so great, and the fact that this show, which your reactions to the story is all of that too, and to think that it came from a picture on the wall that arbitrarily Joseph was asked to basically come in and pick half a dozen pictures and then find various playwrights and authors to write little scenes, and we had a troupe of actors, and we basically, it was one of those processional kinds of shows where the actors would just go around and sit in front of one of the paintings, and the audience would move through the galleys.
We need to credit Dana Cohen, who was at the time the head of the Writing for Stage and Screen program, for coming up with the ekphrastic program.
Right, that's right.
I only came in to direct The Minstrel. Well,
you're right. No, I'm glad you clarified that, because it just, I wanted to make sure the people here and on the air, our audience knew about the diversity of performance, where it can come from.
Yes,
and the collaboration necessary.
Absolutely.
to not just create, but to improve and improve and improve in the interaction with audience and taking all that information full circle. You're giving me a much better sense of, I've heard the word workshopping. With related to plays, but I guess, is that an accurate description of simplified way of saying what you're talking about?
Yes, exactly. It can go from a simple table read where the actors have no rehearsal to a rehearsed reading to a form of a workshop where you start putting up on its feet and see what it looks like, and then you start building your collaborative group of designers, set designers, costume designers, sound designers, lighting designers, projection designers.
Yeah.
That's a new layer of design that in the last 10, 20 years. So So, yeah, it is a collaborative process. And in terms of theater, you know, that playwright who writes the play alone in her or his room doesn't finish the work until the other people get involved. Right. It's not until it's fully produced, it's not really done. So the playwright has to go through the whole process mm-hmm. of all of those steps to see what it wants to become and learns on each step. And that's what the process series was about, helping the playwright in this, if it was a play, helping the playwright, you know, learn what the play is doing and where it needs to go. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we do like a reading in the process series twice, like Friday and Saturday night. There are playwrights who rewrite an entire act between the Friday night and Saturday night because it's an active process. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But plays can come from and performances can come from so many different places.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, it's in a way, it's probably not till a piece is embodied in a performance that you really feel the truth of parts and whether things work or not.
Yeah, and also getting really smart actors and directors in the room mm-hmm. and then smart designers in the room, then it all lifts. Mm-hmm. You know, it all lifts.
Well, yeah, everybody feeds off of each other, and you know, what about that? Or what about that? Or and because the environment in a successful group is that nobody feels threatened, that anybody is intruding on their territory. Everybody is open to just whatever happens. And because there's a level of discernment, people are aware of what's a good idea and what's a bad idea and what's, well, I don't know, but we won't know until we try it, so let's try it. You know, there's a fearlessness and a bravery and an openness and a vulnerability that kept me from being a performer, but it kept me from being, you know, somebody who could be in part of that vicariously by coming up with the offstage stuff. Mm-hmm. So that was just an amazing process series. And Street Signs, your Street Signs and Harlan's Creek are two other venues, outlets you have for creativity right. and stuff like that are... The Street Signs was more specifically about developing work from literature, or it started out that way?
Both literature
and... How is it different?
Street Signs is a nonprofit theater company that Derek Goldman founded, and Derek was here at mm-hmm. the university yeah. and then took a job at Georgetown and basically very generously handed to Elizabeth, my partner, and to me,
right.
the nonprofit company, and we kept it going. The idea of Street Signs is Street Signs was based pieces based on literature, but also rethinking the classics.
Absolutely. Okay,
so, like right. we did a new Miser, for example,
right.
through Street
yeah,
Signs that you designed.
Yeah, Poof wound up, and several shows are all around the triangle.
Yes, exactly. so that is, became. An outlet for full productions, and has been a big supporter. Street Signs has been a big supporter of the process series the last 5 years because the university doesn't always come up with all the resources I need.
Yes, I remember those.
But one of the things that we got to do is also create things through the process series that didn't exist before, and one of the sort of the prouder moments, there were two created pieces based on oral histories. And this is one of the benefits of being at a mm-hmm. at a research institution like UNC, mm-hmm. is there are a lot of resources.
Yeah.
Unless they close the institutes that those resources come from, but that's a whole other political conversation.
I get those emails still, too.
Yeah, but there's a Southern Oral History Program, mm-hmm. right? And so years ago, I was asked to put together a piece called The Black Pioneer Project about the first black alumni from 52 to 72 from UNC. And their stories were pretty amazing, and we created a piece based on those oral histories that was a performance through the process series. And it was a really incredibly well-received piece. And because of that piece, one of the development directors at the university who was working with LGBTQ people saw it and said, can we do the same for LGBTQ alumni? And we created The Story of Us, which was a three-hour extravaganza
wow.
of oral histories. It wasn't supposed to be, but it was, because there were so many stories. But there were three-hour piece based on oral histories of past LGBTQ alumni at the university, and we did it at the FedEx Center. And I brought in a trans DJ to play music in between stuff. And there were a lot of stories that were featured. And one of the stories became in its own one-person show. Pardon me while my mind blanks for Janora McDuffie, who is a lesbian actor in L.A. and also a graduate of the program at UNC, wrote an amazing oral history, and I encouraged her to create a one-person show. And that one-person show then, she created it based on that oral history, and then I directed that in L.A., and we're going to take it to New York and possibly Atlanta.
That's the one you did last fall in
yeah.
L.A.? Okay.
Yeah.
Which is why you're not on the show then, you're not on the show now.
Yeah, exactly.
So because you were in L.A. So this is exactly why we were hoping to get you on the show, to just let our audience know that these kind of things exist, and there are people who think that my story doesn't count, but as soon as they sit down and start to write out their own oral history, what we're talking about is basically letting people know that they don't have to just write it and put it in a file on a flash drive and a thing, or type it out on paper and put it in a box under the bed. It can go on to create a performance. It can go on and be seen and can grow and expand and get our stories out. I mean, I don't remember exactly when your three-hour epic happened, but I don't know that had I known, I do not know if I would have said, oh, hey, me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the things I'm doing with my being in the show.
Mm-hmm.
The radio show out on the edge is
telling our stories is a very powerful thing to do.
Yeah.
And
I'm going to interrupt
okay.
because I'm looking at what's coming up February 20 and 21 at the Black Box Theater in Swain Hall about meditations on death and life. And since we're with the Department on Aging, I think it's important for people to know about. What's the capacity for the Black Box Theater?
It's about 85 seats.
Mm-hmm.
I've never had a problem getting everybody in. I find ways.
I would like to let our Project Engage classmates know about that. And I know
please
that
do.
At least a couple people in that group who would be interested.
So this is a story. Anna Verseni, who's been a professor at Dramatic Art for years and years and has been on the advisory board for the Process Series, and I've done called a translation. He publishes a journal of translated plays.
What journal?
It's called Mercurian. It's a journal of translated plays. Into English from other languages.
Okay.
And we've done two translation festivals together where we've brought in like four or five plays for the Process Series, mm-hmm. four or five mm-hmm. new translations, thinking of translations needing the same care as new plays. I mean, it's a new translation. The translator wants to hear it, see how it's working, see what's not making sense, see what's working, what's clicking with American and
yeah.
English audiences.
Wow.
So we've done that twice. But one day he called me and said, and just told me the story, just as friends, over a beer. He told, and I don't drink beer, but we did over a beer. And he told me the story of taking his mother, his 92-year-old mother, to Switzerland to die. And this was a really, I mean, he just sort of, it just came out of him, the story. And I wasn't the first person he called to tell, obviously. And I listened and I listened and I said, you need to write that down. You need to make it a one-person show.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm not ready for that, but thank you for suggesting that. And two months later, he called me and said, now I'm ready for it. and he started working on it over the summer, and we've done internal readings between the two of us.
Mm-hmm.
We We brought in some actors to read it too, and we worked on the script. We worked on the script, and out of that is going to come this performance of An Empty Fullness: Meditations on Death and Life by Adam Resenier. I directed. He's going to perform the story of he and his sister taking his mom to Switzerland to die. And it's also for him, because he had two sort of incredibly traumatic deaths in his life. His father died early age, and his wife died when he had two daughters. And, you know, they had two daughters, and his wife died of cancer. Both of these things were incredibly traumatic. And it's a live meditation on how we think about death, both in his past with these traumas, but also with his mother, where she got to choose the way she wanted to die.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's sort of an extraordinary story that will touch, I think, everybody who lives and has to deal with the fact that we're all still mortal, even no matter how much we would like not to be, or for some, and some are just happy to go. But I find the story to be deeply moving, and it does what art should do: ask some fundamental questions about, you know, how to live, how to be, and then maybe how to you know, and how to make death as a part of the experience of life.
Because it is a part of the experience of life.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
So I'm just going to say this show's going to be on Friday and Saturday, February 20th and 21st, at the Black Box Theater in Swain Hall. So if anybody's listening and finds this interesting, you know, look online for something called An Empty Fullness: Meditations on Death and Life.
And that's Process Series, one word, processseries.unc.edu. And you can actually, you don't have to, but you can reserve tickets for it at that website.
Okay, that is good to know, because we know groups, organizations who I think would be very interested in this. We'll make sure the word gets out.
We've already been approached to take the piece to, you know, to other places that, you know, that might have large groups of people who might want to see it. And I think Adam would be very interested in that.
Well, if he wants to try something else out, I'm thinking there's an 84-seat theater at the Seymour Center in Chaffeuville.
There you go.
And you might get another older audience there, actually.
There you go.
Which could be interesting.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And
totally
in possibility. Addition to this, just to circle back to Freight, the Five Incarnations of Abel Green, you have a screening on campus day after tomorrow?
On Thursday.
Oh, Thursday? Okay.
The Thursday, it's the 12th. Right? Of February? Thursday? Right? And
yes, because Valentine's Day is Saturday. I have to remember that day.
So, on the 12th at 5 p.m. at the Stone Center.
Stone Center, yeah.
There's no tickets to reserve for this. Is a screening of... So we did Freight in Los Angeles 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And Alphonse raised money with some producers to shoot the play that we did at the Fountain Theater.
You're answering the question that I was about to ask.
Yes. So
I didn't realize.
So this was after it closed, but the set was still up. So he shot the play at the Fountain Theater with professional cinematographers, and he directed and was in it. The film.
Right,
Of the play I directed.
Right, yes.
Right? And now it's been on into several festivals. It won a festival, the Urban World Festival. And it's going to be streaming on Starz Network, where his show P-Valley has been airing, so people know him from Starz. And it is going to stream there for, I think, a year, but it started on February 1st. So people could watch Freight on Starz, or they could come and for free see a screening of Freight at the Stone Center at 5 p.m., on Thursday, where you can meet Alphonse and the playwright
and
Howard Kraft.
Yeah.
And the director, Joseph Meagle.
And the director.
Yeah.
The three of them there. It's like, it's one of those things. I loved working on both iterations of the show that I did, which was at Acklin, and then when we mounted it at Swain and put it up in those big, stupid, heavy sliding screens that were back and forth between railroad cars and, you know, and then wind up in the subway. And it was just, it was wonderful with all that sort of stuff. And then it went on to Off-Broadway, and I was waving a fond good luck, Mazel Tov. But just to then think about just... It was very skin of our pants putting the shows together at the Acklin, kind of like, what are we doing? Everything. I mean, we had some wonderful playwrights, wonderful director. I mean, it was just, it was great, but it's like, okay, this is the weirdest thing I think I've ever done. And now it's look at just the way it's grown like that is just amazing to me. And I mean, I found out about the film this morning. Yeah. I didn't realize it had been filmed ever. I knew it had played in New York and Los Angeles, but I didn't realize it was a permanent actor. And it's going to be on Stars. It's like,
and there's a film company called Macro that's also purchased the rights to the last iteration, which is the Saturn Bound. It's called Saturn Bound Man.
Yeah.
And Howard has written a screenplay based on that iteration alone, and hopefully that will get. Produced. It's in, you know, it's what they in Los Angeles called in development. And that the development process in film is a little bit different than the development process in theater. But so a lot of things came out of that. And clearly, I mean, Alphonse's career really took off after the New York shows. We did one year here, and then we did the other at the New Federal Theater where Woody,
Who recently passed.
Who really recently passed, a very important theater maker, produced Freight. So we produced it twice in New York and got critics' pick in New York's Times. And it really transformed, I think, Alphonse's career. And he's doing really well. So he's doing well in Los Angeles. He's booking one thing after the other. And... he's pitching projects, and we'll see where how far he can sort of fly.
Wow! I mean, again, it couldn't. Yes, he's earned everything that he has gotten, but he deserves all of that recognition, and I'm just so glad for him to be able to be recognized for works. Mm-hmm. So many people don't get that recognition, that don't get noticed.
So we have about that much time.
Wait, I'm sorry.
Yeah. We have about 10 minutes.
Yeah. Well, let me think.
In a conversation that we could probably take a few hours.
Over a wine,
if that's what you prefer,
about,
Joseph.
The kind of stuff, because again, I wanted us to let our audience know about this whole art form that they may not have any idea about it existing, and about the creation of art, and that goes so much to the heart of. Us as queer people of an age needing to create our set down our histories and so many different forms whether it's like Mac, Judy's husband, is a puppeteer and a composer, and he expresses himself through many multiple art forms and stuff like that. And Judy's a poet. Her poem for the her piece was selected for the Chapel Hill mixtape by the poet laureate of Chapel Hill. Mine wasn't, but hers was. That's okay. I'm very happy for her.
She's also part of the Legacy Project that the School of Social Work is doing. And I'll be able to do my story in 9 minutes or less for the project that...
You put a bunch of those 9-minute stories together, you've got another process series event.
Or
your
go.
Own, and you don't even need a process series. You can just put it up as a performance.
It's a program that's an all-day program on aging this year. They have a topic each
there are,
year.
There are theater programs that focus on aging as a part of what they do. I taught for one semester at UNLV, and they had an aging program at the theater department there. But that's not the only one. There's a lot of theater programs that, you know, sort of look at aging and will do, again, interviews and oral histories with older populations and create work from that. Mm-hmm. So it's an important art form. I think that's the nice thing about performance. There's not really a subject that you can't lift or understand in a different way using performance and illuminate things that we may not think about. and make us feel about it, that if you read about it, you might think about it intellectually, but if you see a performance, maybe you mix both the emotion, the heart, mm-hmm. and the head.
Right. One of the things, I'm just sort of spitballing here, but one of the things that I'm thinking of is we, again, of a certain age, sit around talking about this. There's one of the things that performance studies, as opposed to scripted performance, is that the age, it's far more fluid in terms of the age of the characters. So it adds a lot more opportunities for people who think, I'm too old, I'm too young, I'm too fat, I'm too tall. I mean, those kind of things matter so much less when you're creating a piece from scratch, from devising a script, a collaboration where everybody brings in pieces of stuff and puts it together to create a story. You break the bonds of, and I'm not saying playwrights have limited imaginations, but sometimes playwrights can get locked into what a character looks like, and they put and the action of the script is centered on that. And so when you come time to put it upstage, you kind of get locked into things, whereas if you're creating it on the fly, a lot of that goes away. So mm-hmm. there's a lot of opportunities for older actors who might think that they're too old for this.
I mean, makes sense.
Is Odyssey Theater still around? Is a specific theater company in the area for older actors?
Not locally, I don't think.
Pardon?
I don't think so.
I've lost track of all of those things since I retired so much longer ago. And mm-hmm. again, the great double whammy of retirement and COVID both hitting me at the same time mm-hmm. is like.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm a little curious. It sounds like you said this is the last season
yes.
of this, and so is it because you're retiring?
Yes.
To do what?
Oh well. Oh.
Is there going to be another? Is there going to be another iteration of this in your future?
I'm always going to do new work. I thought deeply about the process here at the university. First of all, they did not create a line to replace me, so. Which is sad because I was one of the makers. In my department, there are scholars, and there are not a lot of people making work anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there is a new professor who's beginning to make sort of more experimental work. But I was a primary maker in the department, and the process series was a big program mm-hmm. that was sponsored by the department. So. It's sad that they're not necessarily, they might, but not mm-hmm. necessarily replacing my line, they say, in the university
okay.
parlance. But I just didn't want the program to lose its shape or vision. I didn't want it to become something it wasn't supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turns out, the university didn't want to continue supporting it without me. So I was informed that the university would stop supporting the process series, the School of Arts and Sciences, and I thought, well, good riddance. I think it's better not to be in the hands of someone who wouldn't take care of it. So I don't know if we'll find another iteration. The work I do is going to a lot of times is going to be new work. I'm going to work with playwrights. I'm going to tell Robin here that. She must create her own story of transition and write it so that we can see it on the stage. So I think that work will always continue, whether it continues in a form of another version of the process series that I do
mm-hmm.
is yet to see. Right now, I think a little rest. I was a one-man band. You know, there are performance organizations. excuse me. There are performance organizations like Playmakers and Carolina Performing Arts on campus. They have staff. They yeah. have marketing people. They have development people. Mm-hmm. They have production people. The process series has Joseph Meagel.
and you helped.
Yes, I have a TD after you left also, Will Bosley, who's been incredibly helpful.
Yeah.
But basically, you know, the whole marketing, the whole budget, raising money, all of that.
How many seasons did I do the posters?
Yeah, exactly.
So you really didn't have a staff. So all this pretty glossy stuff.
Yeah,
you didn't have a staff to do
this. I didn't have a staff to do it. I work with a graphic designer who I hire, but I'm the one who's working with them. And my partner, Elizabeth, and the TD, and a couple work-study students who, you know, will do. But the point is that there's a lot of...
It's hard work.
It's a heavy lift.
It's hard work, and there does... You know, from the elders, your elders here, we know there's a time at which you kind of say, I'm tired. You know, I'm kind of done with this. You know it. But that doesn't mean you walk off to nothing.
Exactly. So, exactly. I think what I was tired of is not having the support, having a marketing staff, not having a production staff, you know.
Right.
And not having, you know, the type of people that you would need to run a performance program like that. Mm-hmm. And so that for 18 years, I had to beg for money from 8 departments every year just to get $8,000. So I feel like that was that alone, the weight of all of that is a lot. And I'm happy not to have that weight anymore.
To close the door.
Yeah.
And that's okay. Transitions, we know, right? Yeah. That is huge in life.
No, I mean, one of the things that I'm proudest of, my work with Joseph and my time at UNC, was basically saving Swain Black Box Theater. We continue to come up with programming for it. We continue to do stuff, innovative stuff, and as we became more and more, as video production became more and more integrated, we kept accommodating that. And as I was telling Betty earlier about running around campus and salvaging discarded overhead projectors from departments and stuff like that. And then right when I retired, they built a new theater for us, but they didn't do it until the ceiling started to fall down on the old one, and they thought about how many lawsuits they were going to get. All of a sudden, you know, we'd been asking, we were doing so many things for so long, the process series, the undergraduate program, the graduate shows, with no money, and just nothing there, and we were getting no support, and then all of a sudden the ceiling started to fall in and said, my goodness, we have to fix this, and it's got a brand new black box that I have not set foot in yet because it all happened.
We've been waiting for you to come.
But maybe we'll be there soon. So I was looking.
I'm going to do that.
Yeah, and sure. I hate to cut you off, but it's time.
Yes. I hate to cut anybody off with this conversation.
And Joseph,
a treat.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's great being here and seeing Robin again.
Again, I thought it was stuff the people needed to know about.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was fascinating. Fascinating.
And you will see me again.
It was such a pleasure being... I look forward to it.
Yes.
And we'll see you here.
Yes.
With the process series.
There are four events. And this, the one that you just talked about and three after that are pretty remarkable. I would love for you to see these last events. They should be, I think... very exciting, and as you say, you'll be seeing me around. I'm not going nowhere.
I'm sure.
That's excellent. Well, thank you to our listeners as well. Join us each week as we interview special guests to share stories for, by, and about our elders in the LGBTQ+ community. You can hear the show on the air Monday afternoons, 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern, or stream us live on WCOMFM.org. Archived shows are posted at orangecountync.gov/OOTE. Do you have questions or ideas for future shows or want to share some love? Please contact us at outontheedgeradio@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. We're going to close today with some inspiration from James Baldwin, and very timely, I might say. The children are always ours, every single one of them, all over the globe. And I'm beginning to suspect that whoever is incapable of recognizing this may be incapable of morality. And we're out.
On Fifth Avenue to see how the other side lives. And if I had a jetpack, I would strap it on. I'd get out of this one room and I'd be gone to where there's real houses and big front lawns. If I had a jetpack, I'd take you up with me. At last we'd both be free past the Statue of Liberty in my jetpack. If I had a jetpack, I'd fly above the bridge. I'd wave to all my friends who thought I'd never rise again. I'd fly above the stadium to watch my team win. Watch my team win. And if I had a jetpack, I'd bust into your door. I'd take you by the hand to the Jersey Shore. And underneath the moonlight, you'd want me even more. Cause I'd have a jetpack. Take you up so high. If I dropped you, you would die. But I want you by my side in my jetpack. Oh, I don't have a jetpack. I don't even have a car. I just have this token in a head.
Aren't you, boy, with your quiet voice and impeccable style? Don't ever let them steal your joy and your gentle ways to keep them from running wild. They can kick dirt in your face, dress you down and tell you that your place is in the middle when they hate the way you shine. I see you tugging on your shirt, trying to hide inside of it and hide how much it hurts. Let them. Discouraged, don't you, girl? It's your brother's world for a while longer. You gotta dance with the devil on a river to beat the stream. Call it living the dream. Call it kicking the ladder. They come to kick dirt in your face, to call you weak and then displace you after carrying your baby on your back across the desert.